This week on the Eldritch Lorecast.
I'll start this segment over. Sorry, Twitch chat, and we'll just run it from there.
James Hake, Saga of Seasons. Mate, let's all just take a breath. Everybody want to take a breath? Let's all just take a breath together. Yeah, we're going to bring it in. Bring it in.
Twitch chat, tell Scott we're better than this.
The people of Valaka are the only ones strong enough to stand against the things that Valaka is trying to do, not just to the north, but to the whole world.
You know, the stories that you want to tell while still hanging on to that glimpse of light within the darkness of winter in Valaka.
I love it. I love Grim Hollow. And I got told a week ago not to look at the camera anymore because I look too creepy.
Black Flag looks like it's got a lot of 5e in it.
All that and more right now.
And welcome to this week's episode of the Eldritch Lorecast, the number one tabletop RPG and 5e adjacent podcast in all the realms. My name is Ben Byrne, and I'm here with Sean Merwin, James Hake, and we are very grateful to have this week filling in for Dale Kingsmill, Scott Fitzgerald Gray. Scott, welcome to the Eldritch Lorecast. Thank you for coming. Thank you for making time.
Thank you for the invitation. Thrilled to be here.
Scott, I have to ask you, coming on to the Eldritch Lorecast, for folks who don't know your work, you're a game designer. You've worked on some Ghostfire gaming products in the past, including Aurora and most recently Valaka. Is there anything else folks should know about you?
I've been working in RPGs for quite a while. I started freelancing for Wizards of the Coast in 2004 during the 3.5 era. I worked on a lot of 4th edition. Worked on a lot of D&D Next. I've been working on 5th edition for Wizards as a freelancer pretty much right from the beginning, right up till the last project I worked for them was Fizban's Treasury of Dragons.
Right, gotcha. Nice.
Look for that name in the Monster Manual. Look at the credits of the Monster Manual.
I was the editor of the Monster Manual. That was fun.
Or any other book that's been published by Wizards since 2004, you will like this guy's name.
I see you're going to have the Sean Merwin shtick of like, what's your favorite thing? Well, the one I wrote.
I'm actually really good at forgetting things that I worked on. So that'll be less of a problem, I think.
Gotcha. Problem? That's a feature. All right. Well, as someone who's been designing for 5e since basically the beginning, and as we are all doomed to, it seems, we'll continue designing for 5e until the heat death of the universe. What is a mechanic, perhaps from another RPG system, that you wish that 5e would implement?
I'm going to answer like an editor. I'm going to give you 1.5 mechanics that I'd love to see in 5e. The 0.5 is one that's actually already technically in 5e, but 5e doesn't actually treat it as a mechanic. It treats it as a one-off. And that's the idea of banes and boons, which will be familiar to anybody if you've played Rob Schwalb's amazing horror fantasy game, Shadow of the Demon Lord. That's the idea that alongside rolling a d20, you roll another die and you add the number on the die or you subtract the number on the die to give you a boost or take it down. And anybody who's played 5e knows that mechanic because it's all throughout 5e. It's in Bardic Inspiration and the Blessed Spell and, you know, all over the place. But for whatever reason, 5e doesn't treat it as a separate mechanic. Every time it appears, it's like a one-off thing and they're not really related to each other. And I would have loved to have seen that become a formal mechanic sort of at the heart of the game. So that even as you talk about rolling with advantage, you can talk about rolling with a bane or a boon, and everyone will understand kind of what it means.
Is that what's referred to as, because I hear this a lot like in wargaming as well, like an embedded mechanic, something that like you can easily reference. It's not only featured where it appears.
I think so, yeah. I mean, 5e does that with a few things. The slowed condition, which is not a condition in 5e, for example. Slowed used to be a condition. And then for 5e, for whatever reason, they decided not to do that. So every time an effect shows up that causes a character to have their speed reduced, it's treated as a one-off effect rather than simply being able to refer to that condition and having like a baseline understanding of what that actually means. In terms of a mechanic that does not exist in any form in 5e, something I was thinking about recently that I loved when I last played Savage Worlds was the idea of interludes, which are this cool narrative beat that you have in between sort of like combat sessions. Sometimes it's like a downtime thing, but it doesn't necessarily have to be. But what it does is it uses the deck of cards that Savage Worlds uses as a randomizer. And you draw a card as a player. and you have the opportunity to advance the narrative by being given a prompt and describing something that your character has done or something that the party has done, sort of in a space sort of in between what actually happened at the table. I actually jotted down some. For example, if you draw a card and it's clubs, you have three options. You can talk about some downtime. You can talk about your hero being broody or angry about something, and you just basically narrate that at the table. You can do backstory, which is you can tell a tale of misfortune from your hero's dark past, which may connect to some secret. Or you can do a trek, which in which you talk about a journey that the party has taken. And you talk about, with the example of clubs, some sort of hardship that the party overcame on their journey, the death of an NPC, some kind of mechanical breakdown, bad weather, whatever it is. And I loved interludes when I was playing Savage Worlds because as a DM, the holy grail for me is I love it when players can engage with the narrative and kick in bits of story, sort of in a really kind of like a cohesive framework. So it's not just a random thing, but everybody knows kind of what's expected of them. Everybody works together to advance the narrative a little bit in a really, like in a group fashion. And interludes in Savage World do that really, really well.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I've done similar things like sit around the campfire and tell a story. You know, one person tells a story each time there's a short rest or something like that. Yeah. I was going to suggest it in a game I was running the other day, and then I chickened out for some reason. I was just like, they won't want to do this. I don't know. But I love it as a concept.
Being a writer and not an editor, I'm going to go for the full two. But one of them actually ties very well to what Scott said. In a Dungeon World, which is an apocalypse world-based game, there are certain moves that any character can do. So it doesn't matter what class you are. These are moves that anyone can do, and they can be very mechanical, or they can be more story-based. Like one is spout lore, or one is carouse. And every character can do that. And it sort of makes all the characters a little more relatable to each other, rather than just I'm the barbarian and I have this unique set of skills, or I'm a wizard and I have this unique set of skills. I would like to see something added to the game that everyone can do and everyone has sort of the same ability to do it and affect the game that way. And it a lot of it plays into exactly what Scott said too, to get more into the role playing aspect of the storytelling aspect of it. The other thing I would like to see, although not in its exact form, is 13th Age's escalation die. The escalation die starts at one or starts at zero, and then it moves up every round of combat. And that bonus, so one plus two plus three as combat goes, gives the players a greater chance to hit as that die increases. They get to add that bonus to their attack roll.
Right.
So their most useful powers, there's a tendency to want to wait a little bit to get that die up a little higher to make sure that that major attack hits. And what it eliminates is the alpha strike, right? The hit everything, everyone use your best skill, your best power, your best attack right away. Now, there are other things that die does, right? Sometimes it's you have to wait until this number happens on the die in order to do something else. Or if the die is even or odd, these different things can happen. So it complicates things a bit, and I'm not always all for that complicating factor, but I do like what it does mechanically with player choices in terms of their not wanting to do the same thing every time a combat starts.
That sounds sick. James Hake, speaking of things that aren't sick, I hope you're not sick.
I'm great. Don't invite that evil upon me, Ben.
What's a mechanic that you would like to see in 5e? Moving right along.
Should I say the sickened condition? No, I won't. There's two that I'm thinking of. And the first one, Roman mentioned in our chat, I would love more combo moves between different characters. I would love that too. I don't have a particularly well thought out thing to say about that because I just thought of it. But I remember when playing third edition, 3.5, there were feats that you could take as party members that would kind of gain increasing benefits the more people had that feat. If I'm remembering this correctly, this could be filtered right through the haze of, you know, 10 years of playing 5e and not remembering third edition very well. But there were definitely something called teamwork feats, and they encouraged a certain kind of play style that the party would all go in for together. Now, in true 3.5 fashion, I believe they became kind of easy to cheese, and, you know, some were completely useless and some were borderline, if not outright game breaking. So I think it's a cool concept, combo moves or teamwork baked into the mechanics. Secondarily, though, I love the flashback mechanic from Blades in the Dark, or the Forged in the Dark engine. It is particularly well suited to the sort of Thieves Guildy heist framework that Blades in the Dark works with quite well. Because, you know, if you're going into a heist-like situation, they're trying to cut out hours of planning that will invariably go awry upon first contact with the enemy. Do I have the right thing, the right grappling hook, the right lockpicking set, that sort of thing? Don't worry about that. You can adjust the narrative to taste in a flashback on the fly. I can see that working very, very well in a dungeon environment. You know, Wizards just announced Keys from the Golden Vault, which is particularly appropriate given its heist-like nature. But even in a normal dungeon-crawling environment, I can imagine, I need to cross this pit. If only I'd, you know, bought a grappling hook in town. It's these sort of, like, equipment-based, you know, little questions that drive me up a wall as a GM who wants the characters to have a fun time in a dungeon. You know, if it would be more fun for them to have the grappling hook, have a flashback where they get a grappling hook. Let's have a fun little scene where I get to invent a quirky little merchant, or, you know, someone who can get that character a grappling hook just as they're leaving town. They almost forgot it, but now they have it, and now something cool can happen, rather than people being like, well, I wish I could do something cool, but now I have to sit here and sit on my hands.
Sure. Well, speaking of doing fun things, Ghostfire Gaming's latest Kickstarter launches this week. Woo-woo! Grim Hollow's Valakan Clans, which includes two new books, The Raider's Guide to Valakar and Saga of the Seasons, which is the adventure module. I just want to let folks know right at the top, we are going to do another stream on Twitch on this channel. It will be on... Sorry, I'm looking at my notes. It'll be on 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Wednesday, 3 p.m. Pacific, Thursday, 10 a.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Time. And that will be just after the Kickstarter launches, which is on Wednesday 15th, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard, 7 a.m. Pacific, 2 a.m. Australian Daylight Time. But hey, Australians wake up on Thursday morning, the Kickstarter's launched. So depending on when you're listening to this Kickstarter, it will either launch or have launched or be launching or be in a state of having launched. In either case, you can definitely go check out the Kickstarter right now. There will be links all over the shop, but there's also one in the Twitch chat for people listening to this live. I've probably said it on the Lorecast before. I remember knowing nothing about what Sean and James and Scott were working on. And then got into a meeting where Sean and James laid out their plans, what Raider's Guide looked like, what the Saga of the Seasons is. And I have basically been in a state of constant excitement since. James Hake,
yes.
Saga of the Seasons is the adventure module. What's something that you are particularly, without giving away too many spoilers, what's something particularly you're excited for folks to experience or discover in that adventure module?
Saga of the Seasons, it might be maybe my favorite adventure I've produced in a very long time. It's got a very grim, hollow, dark fantasy feel to it, not just because of, you know, it's in the setting, because there are scary and morally gray things that happen in it. Those things happen, but also because we've taken an approach to the mechanics of the adventure to keep you from feeling like you are in a high fantasy, epic fantasy superhero milieu like D&D often likes to do. And we've done that by restricting the time it takes. Or I should say expanding the time it takes for you to get to that level of power. And let me explain what I mean here. I don't think that the D&D leveling curve suits itself very well to dark fantasy. People have a tendency to go from the power of dirt farmers to demigods over the course of about a month of in-game time. Now, it took you 3 years IRL to make that happen, so it doesn't feel like there's anything wrong with that, perhaps. But when you look back on it, you're like, wow, we really became the most powerful beings in the multiverse just by putting in a little elbow grease over the course of a month. Why isn't everyone like this? Well, Saga of the Seasons takes a look at the classic Volsung sagas of real-world Vikings and their the full year of their life. In spring, Viking people went to plant the seeds and build ships. And then in the summer, all of those farmers put down their tools and picked up blades and shields and went raiding. And then in fall, they harvested. In winter, they hunkered down. And so taking all of those real-world challenges, we stretched it into the realm of fantasy, into the realm of fun and action and horror. So in Saga of the Seasons, you're playing as a group of Valakin champions who are leading the creation of a brand new Valakin clan, Clan Ragval. And over the course of 52 weeks, one full calendar year in the world of Aetheris, you start at fairly low levels, helping your local villagers out with problems that come from living on the frontier. There are werewolves in the woods. People have gone missing. Kobolds have infested the basement. They're stealing the grain. All of these very sort of down-to-earth things. But then you're doing that so you can gain renown and gain skills so that you can go off and raid the Northlands of the Burak Empire, do the Valakin thing, gain honor, have a saga sung by the Skalds about you when you return with glory and wealth from the riches, from the walls of Erlfurt. And then you engage in some sort of political drama in autumn, some magic comes to the fore. And then in winter, you're put on the back foot when the monsters of winter's darkness emerge from their slumber and try to destroy you. Now you are on the receiving end, the defensive end of a raid, and you have to put everything that you learned in summer to work the other way around. So that's Saga of the Season. That's its four big season-focused chapters. And you really get to see your settlement, which is rife with very colorful and interesting, but still grounded NPCs. See them develop, see their relationships change, not just between each other, but between you and them as well. And make choices. Make choices. Like, do you think that the village chief is doing a poor job of leading you? Do you think you could do better? Do you think that there are people who would join your cause in usurping the chief and becoming the ruler of this village? Do you think that you could find another way to gain greater glory in the eyes of the six well-established Valakin clans? All of that is in there. I think it's a really fantastic adventure.
It is very mythic and epic, but it's also, and I think this is really key for dark fantasy, very personal, right? Like, this is your clan. This is your saga. Yeah. These are your family, you know, in a way, whether literally or found family. And I really look forward to starting the campaign and just starting with the session zero and being like, all right, what are your jobs in the clan? Not what is your class, but what is your job? How are you part of this community and really build that community feel for then this epic story to kind of use as a grounding and kind of earthing base?
I think it's great you say that. One of the last things that I snuck into this book, I hope it survives layout. I hope we don't have any, like, too many pages and have to strip it out. But there are advanced backgrounds in the Grimhollow campaign guide that I think are often overlooked, even here at the company. And so I wanted to take those and insert them into the introduction when you are kind of developing your character's early years with the clan, with Clan Ragval, and creating, you know, what does this advanced background mean for your role in the village? And I go through all the advanced backgrounds in the Grimhollow campaign guide and be like, this is what you do in the village. This is who you might know already and have a bond with in your background among the village NPCs. So that you already feel like you're not just some adventurer that's rolled in out of the wastes. You have a history with this clan. It might not be a long one. This is the first real year. You barely survived a winter, and this is the clan's first real year. But you met someone encourage you to join this bold madcap expedition that Chief Odd-Scare mounted to create this new clan. Why are you here?
Mm.
And that's fertile ground for you to start being not just a Valakin wandering adventurer, warrior, knight errant, but someone who is deeply committed to this village and who wants to raid and build its glory and make it into something that the other six clans will have to respect.
Mm. Jumping to the other side of things, we have the other book, The Raider's Guide to Valakar. There is a lot in this book, and we also have stretch goals as well that we're hoping to hit for the Kickstarter itself. The thing that I absolutely love, and I believe, Scott, you had a huge hand in this back when it was being sort of designed for Aurora, is the what it's called the clan affiliation kind of character creation system in Valakin clans.
Right.
But I want to talk to you and Sean a little bit about how this system fits into 5e, how it still feels, in my opinion, distinctly 5e and yet like an evolution of the sort of heritage, lineage, style, racial background, species, whatever, you know, whatever X system or company is calling it. I feel like this just kind of finds a way to go beyond it. Can you explain to me what I'm talking about? What is what was it called in Aurora, and what is this system, and what were its initial roots, if you will?
I'll start, and then I'm going to pass it on to Scott. So,
sure.
What worked for us in Aurora was we didn't want races because races don't fit into the story that we were telling with Aurora. Every creature that's born right now in Aurora is its own unique entity, has no racial, genetic, whatever you want to call it, lineages pushing it forward. It is its own unique thing. So I wanted a system where we could allow players to build their own, characters from scratch before you even thought about backgrounds or classes. You build your own character, who that character is, what that character looks like. And Scott seemed to me to be the person who was in the best position to be able to do that. So I handed that very small, innocent, easy to do task over to Scott, who I believe was already working on something similar in other projects that he'd worked on. And at that point I said, Scott, could you do this? And
yeah, I mean, I've been fascinated by the idea of kind of freeform character building for quite a while. I really like that idea. One of the from a Grognard's perspective, one of the really interesting things about the evolution of D&D is how much of the focus of the game has been about character customization. Because as Sean knows, or as anyone knows who started out with AD&D or the older versions of the game, your character customization back in the day was basically you pick your name, and that was, you know, pretty much it, right? If you wanted to customize a character, stylize a character, there were ways to do it. If you're playing AD&D, the primary way was your choice of magic items for a lot of different characters, right? If you're a caster, your choice of spells, that would kind of create a signature feel for your character. But the idea of customizing, you know, sub-races, as they've been called in the past, and sort of, you know, customizing ancestries and backgrounds and things like that, those things just didn't exist. And those things have come into the game in increasing numbers as the additions have gone on. And when Sean pitched the idea of what he wanted to do with Aurora, which was basically exactly what he said there in the first meetings that we had, I loved the idea because it's mechanically fun. The idea to give players a chance to freely choose the kind of character they want to build, but also it made perfect sense for the Aurora setting. What Sean wanted to do with that in terms of the magical pedigree of all the sapient creatures in the world, right? Made absolute perfect sense that they would be drawn from all these different ancestries, that any character could draw something freely from anything, from any ancestry that had ever touched its own lineage in the past, right? So it was a huge amount of fun to work on. The one thing that we talked about very early on, was the idea of what does this do to the balance of a character sure. that you're going to build.
Yeah.
Because if you look at the races in the 5th edition Player's Handbook, the ancestries in other games, there is a nominal sense that you want a character who chooses one ancestry to be roughly balanced with a character who chooses another. Now, thankfully for our purposes, 5th edition, I don't think, does this as well as it probably should have. And there are some clear choices of race in the standard races that if you take them, you're really getting a bit of a bump over what some of the other races will provide you. So what we were able to do that made this a really fun project to work on and really made it feasible was just to say we don't care that much about trying to balance these things. We're going to focus on making sure that none of them are overpowered compared to others. But we want to give players the option to choose stuff not just because it's the best mechanical boon, but because it offers some great opportunities for role-playing as well. To be able to say, this is who my character is, this is where my character comes from. These are the things that have fed into them from their distant ancestors that they never met and that they don't remember and that they have no concept of. In some cases, this is stuff coming to characters from worlds that don't exist anymore. Because that's the amazing backstory of Aurora, the way everything sort of funnels into this one world, having come from other worlds that have vanished under the onslaught of the big bad in that campaign. And once we started doing that, it was really just a matter of saying what things do we think are really cool that already exist in the standard setup of races and ancestries in 5e style games, and what things do we think should be there that haven't been represented before. And from there, it was just a matter of workshopping ideas and sort of hammering the mechanics down. And then, what came out of it was a really cool section and something that I think is very, very unique.
And one of the things we did, which was exciting, was you get choices and we put them into categories of sort of the pillars, right? Combat, role-playing, exploration. And if you so chose, you could spend 2 slots to choose one to get a little bump up in the power of that thing. So you could tweak your character to be a really good flyer rather than just something that could fly, or a really good liar rather than someone who is just okay at lying. You could really tailor the characters in that way. And what we decided to do then when we moved on to Valka, to the Valkan Clans project, was use that same concept but have it tied to the region where you live or your clan. Because each clan is known for something. Clan Rune is known for its magic use, right? Volgr is known for its militaristic side. So we could take those same options and we could group them together to say, if you belong to this clan, whether you're still with the clan, whether you just joined the clan, you have these options. Now you can use anything and you can still build a character the way that you would for a regular 5e campaign. But here, DMs, you're pretty experienced if you're playing Grim Hollow stuff. See how your players like this. You know what you're doing. Let them go. And it gives everyone the chance to do something a little different than they might in a typical 5e campaign.
Yeah, I love the way that it kind of works like a tech tree, as you were describing, Sean, where you can kind of advance options to get stronger at a specific ability, or you can kind of spread your abilities. I love the way that it informs kind of the culture that you're from within the Valakan clans, and again, paired with Saga of the Seasons, helps you feel like you are part of that region. And as Joey said, didn't just wander in from the wilderness. I love that. And I also love that it's just so applicable, because when I saw it for Aurora, I was like, okay, this is cool. This is different. This is a different way of doing things. I would never have conceived using it for Valica, because it seemed so high fantasy in its use in Aurora. And then when I saw the way that it was ported over, it just opened my brain and I was like, you could use this for anything, you know, like I'm playing Hades at the moment, which is a video game, and I'm getting deep into my Greek mythology. And I'm like, what if you use that same system, but instead it was like tied to where you're from within mythological Greece, you know? Mm-hmm. And so people who were born in Hades get like certain necrotic style buffs, and people that were born in Sparta is like, they get the military buffs. So I think it's a genius system that just also solves a lot of problems that Scott, you were saying before around the choices of race within 5e, because even if they are theoretically roughly balanced against each other, if you're playing a barbarian, there's a good chance you're playing an orc or a half orc or a Goliath or something. And if you're playing a wizard, there's a good chance you're playing an elf or a tiefling or something like that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think it's the existing race setup in 5e and certainly what we've seen of 1D&D so far. You know, it's all good mechanically. It's all interesting from the perspective of story and from the perspective of role-playing. But it does tend to shoehorn characters into specific roles. And it makes it mechanically disadvantageous to try to do something a little bit different, right?
Yeah.
And in a game where the ostensible goal is, you know, to tell any story that your imagination can come up with, it seems like a bit of a step backwards to limit the imaginations of players when they're actually starting the character that they want to build. And they're working with sort of the baseline concept of, wow, wouldn't it be cool to play an orc, you know, whose background is, you know, primordial elemental spell casting. You know, they're one with the weather or the volcanoes of the area that they live in. And it is a cool concept, but it's not necessarily an easy concept to build out using the standard rules, where even if you've got some options for sub-races or sub-ancestries, you're still very much locked into the classic tropes of what each of those original creatures that have been part of D&D forever are expected to do and are expected to be.
And because they're so granular, and I'm not talking about and because 5e is so non-granular in the way that it does these races and sub-races, whenever they want to publish something that breaks the mold, they need to create something that only a very small segment of the player base is going to use, because there's a reason why these sort of big tropes, these genre cliches, appear. And it's because everyone knows them and everyone kind of knows how they work, and a lot of people might even want to play with them, especially if they're new to playing D&D, especially if they aren't jaded like us and we want anything new. We're desperate for some kind of variety in our fantasy. And so it's a lot of work for not a lot of gain to make a brand new boundary breaking sub race or whatever like that. Whereas, you know, in a system like this, you create a bunch of cool traits that anyone or a large variety of people can pick. You kind of slot them together and you make something that's distinctly your own. And anyone else could use that trait in a very cliche way or in a boundary breaking way. It's all very usable. And not a lot of stuff is wasted in a system like this, which might be my favorite part of it, the elegance of it all.
Mm. The other thing I quickly want to talk about when it comes to Valakar, you know, we've kind of talked about them in the background, is the clans themselves, the six major clans, and then the lesser clans. Scott, I know that you did a bit of work on, I think, the lore for the Thrall faction of clans. What did you enjoy about that? What are you excited for people to discover in reading the lore?
I'm honestly excited about pretty much everything that we did in that section of the book. I'm in a great position because I know what's in one of the books and I have no idea what's in the adventure at this point. And I know how good the lore is, I'm also still really excited to see what James and his team came up with. I got to sort of sit in on the Slack chat, so I heard them talking about cool stuff they were working on, which was very exciting. But now I get to at some point see it actually come to life. Mm-hmm. The challenge of doing a book like this one is that you're building on existing lore. We're looking at what's in the original campaign guide, and we're saying, okay, this is our starting point. Where can we take it from here? So there was a lot of workshopping. There was a lot of going back and forth. A lot of talking about what things were possible and what things, you know, would be the most interesting to pursue. And I think at the end of the day, what we came up with is, and if I'm paraphrasing this wrong, or if Sean would put it another way, I'm sure he will correct me, but a setting whose grim qualities and whose dark qualities absolutely cannot occlude the light and the hope and the strength of the people who are living within it. Mm. That's the thing that really kind of anchors everything that's going on there. there's all sorts of factions who are engaged in nefarious stuff, right? There's evil up there that I think can rank in the darkest, most intense villains and factions in any other D&D campaign setting that's ever been done. But even that's not enough to break the will and to break the spirit of the people who live there and who live under that. All of them, ultimately, at the end of the day, it's not their goal. Their goal isn't just survival, but the goal for survival kind of is the foundation for how they view their lives, because survival itself is tough in Valinor.
Yeah.
Right. That's the baseline. And I think for a lot of the setup there, it was really a matter of, in fourth edition, there was the phrase points of light, because that was the sort of the baseline foundation for the non-campaign setting that fourth edition had. Fourth edition didn't have an official setting. It sort of dropped little bits of lore and things that had happened, and there was an empire and now it's gone. But the idea was that for the most part, the world is filled with nothingness, but there are these little points of light, isolated islands of civilization, right? Where things are still good, where people are hanging on for dear life, right? And that's what your characters are kind of involved in. That's what they're supporting and trying to strengthen and trying to defend. And that sense comes through very strongly in Valica as well. There's so much in Valica that can overwhelm you. And at the end of the day, I think what we were trying to get across as a primary point was that the people of Valica are the only ones strong enough to stand against the things that Valica is trying to do, not just to the north, but to the whole world.
That's a great explanation for it. And it fits perfectly into the whole idea of Grim Hollow with its transformations and its dark, grim background, which is you can do good things, but become evil while doing them. Or you can do evil things for good reasons, or do good things for what are ostensibly evil reasons. And all of that plays into the different threads of drama happening in Valica.
Yeah.
From you know, the far east to the far western reaches, there are several problems that clans are dealing with. And they're dealing with it in the best way they know how. And as a player or as a game master, you're going to be able to tell some amazing stories and challenge each other to tell, you know, the stories that you want to tell while still hanging on to that glimpse of light within the darkness of winter in Valica.
I love it. I love Grim Hollow, and I'm so excited for Valica. The sort of like glaring thing that I always forget to talk about when I dive into the character creation and the story and Saga of Seasons, but it's one of the things that excites me the most about this Kickstarter is the raiding mechanics. They are so cool. I ran a raid for a video that we'll have coming out sort of once the Kickstarter launches. So if you want to get a literal look at how the raiding mechanics work, we'll have that video coming. Where am I looking? Where's my eye line? Right there. But I got told a week ago not to look at the camera anymore because I look too creepy if I'm just staring at it. It's the brow. but yeah, the raiding mechanics are just, having gotten to play test them as someone with a bit of a wargaming background, they excite me. One of the people that I play tested them with, Matt Perkins, who might be in the chat, I'm not sure. He sitting down with him and explaining how they worked and him kind of like, you know, thinking, listening and thinking about it and having the exact moment that I did when we play tested them internally and just gone, oh, okay, this is cool. All right, I'm excited. All right, let's do this. Like, let's go. Like, once you realize that your choice is laid out in front of you. But just quickly, the other thing that I love about them is I just said war game. Don't let that scare you off. The thing that I love about these raiding mechanics is they fit effortlessly into 5e. They feel distinctly 5e. They are simple and elegant in their design so that they really are just another type of combat encounter that might take the party, I don't know, 45 minutes to an hour and a half of a session like a normal combat would, depending on how much the party want to kind of discuss and debate and or all that sort of jazz. But they're not like the GM can explain them in like 5 minutes and everybody understands and everybody's in and everybody's making decisions together and the risk reward system's incredible. It's just so good.
This is the sort of thing, the rating mechanics might be the best handshake that Raider's Guide and Saga of the Seasons does. Mm. I mean, the lore clicks together perfectly, obviously, but in terms of mechanics, the rating mechanics, when I was going through them in editing, I was like, this looks really dense. If I got served these, I would be scared. I would be like, oh no, I have to learn what?
Yeah.
But just like you were saying, just like when I ran it for you, Ben, and like when you ran it for Maddie P, it clicks into place so easily. And all you really need is a demonstration. I think our video will do that. But also, Saga of the Seasons puts three different raids in it. It's summer season. It's all about raiding. And on top of that, there's like five or something like that defensive raids in winter as well that give you really clear examples of how you might use these mechanics so that you don't have to go into it for the very first time being like, okay, and now I need to make a perfectly balanced raid.
Yeah.
Because the book already does that for you. And because it's got a sort of progression curve baked into the adventure itself, it's also got a sort of complexity curve that will ease both the players and the GMs into the way that this brand new subsystem, as quick to get as it is, actually works.
Yeah. I'm excited to use it. Like in the campaign that I'm running at home, the party are about to go through the Grey Spine and enter, I think it's Fallowheart off the top of my head, which is a city in Astoria that is controlled, kind of split between Ravo and Soma. And I hope I'm saying that right with my Australian accent. I'm looking forward to them getting there because they know nothing about Astoria, kind of learning about the nobles and the warriors and the guilds and whatnot on both sides. And then I kind of want that leg of the campaign to climax with an adaption of the raid mechanics to be like, all right, great. You've sided with Ravo, you start on the north and you're going to be like fighting your way south. If you side with Soma, you start in the south and you'll be fighting your way north. Because I just think they're so elegant. And I think that players who might struggle with systems being introduced to 5e will really be able to grab onto these very, very simply. I'm excited. We have a stream, as I said earlier, if you've just come into the episode, we have a stream which is going to be happening on Wednesday, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Wednesday, 6 p.m., 3 p.m. Pacific, Thursday, 10 a.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Time. It'll be Sean, James, and myself, and we will be diving into even more detail about Valakar. I'm going to make James make a character using the clan alliance system, that affiliation system we've been talking about. We'll talk more about raiding. It's going to be a good time. Come hang out. And the Kickstarter goes live again, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time on Wednesday. So that morning, 7 a.m. Pacific in Australia, it'll be live when you wake up on Thursday. So, or you can stay up until 2 a.m. And get in early, get in on the ground floor. The curse of being on the good side of the news cycle is that we probably won't get to any listener emails this week. I'm sorry, Rob. I'm trying to get to your email, Rob. It was a really good question and it keeps fitting really well thematically with what we've been talking about the last couple of weeks. But Kobold Press have released their first little playtest packet for Black Flag. And in addition to that, they've also announced some of the partners that are working with them on Black Flag as well, which Ghostfire Gaming happens to be part of. We're really excited to see how Black Flag is shaping up, especially in these post-OGL war kind of time. As we talked a lot about last week, we're seeing a diversification of the 5e space. But just to let folks know, to manage expectations, Ghostfire doesn't have anything to announce yet for Black Flag in terms of like an actual product or anything. We're focused on Valakar at the moment, which hypothetically will be fully compatible with Black Flag, which is exciting to say. Nothing to announce in terms of an actual product. But I got to look at the playtest this morning. I've actually got it right here as well. Scott, Sean, James, by our powers combined, how do we feel about this playtest? What do we like that's in there?
Well, big picture, we will probably be able to make it compatible with Black Flag without doing anything.
Yeah, we'll just change the 5e compatible logo to just Black Flag one. Black Flag logo. Yeah, done. Easy.
Black Flag looks like it's got a lot of 5e in it. And for people who like 5e but are fed up with Wizards of the Coast, there you go. Look at that.
Done.
Yeah, it's got a couple of details, which I'm sure will come out as we talk about it more. But honestly, I mean, if you want a 5e alike, this looks like it's going to be a really good 5e alike.
As James said, it's wonderful in the sense that if we want to have compatible products across many different iterations of a game, this is going to fit very well into the overall product cycle of many companies that want to continue to support 5e as is, that might want to support Black Flag, that might want to support, you know, even more versions of RPGs that we see that have this sort of lineage. No pun intended on lineage there.
What a great segue you've given us, Sean.
Yeah, I really liked a lot of what was in it as well. I just gave it a read this morning when it came out. I especially liked the division of lineage into lineage and heritage. I think that's a really obvious thing to do. It's mechanically very, very sound. I think it's a much better framework for creating stylized versions of different lineages. I should also say, sorry, just take a step back. Very happy that Cobalt Press moved away from the word race and adopted lineage, which was something they had just with the first announcements a week or two ago, I think. It looked like they were going with that, and they listened to folks who had some thoughts and opinions on that. And they listened, which is nice. What we were talking about earlier in terms of, like, you know, wanting to build a character who's outside the standard mold of the orc warrior and the dwarf fighter or cleric and the elf magic user. Like right now in this, like for the dwarf, for example, we've got the forged dwarf heritage, and we've got the stone heritage, which is, you know, your dwarf is either hammering on metal or hammering on rock, one or the other. But within that framework, you can see the potential for having an arcane ancestry heritage set up for dwarves, right? You can think about what specific spellcasting traditions the dwarves must have developed, you know, living underground for tens of thousands of years, right?
Yeah.
And I love, like, even if that's not part of the core rules, even if that's something that Cobalt Press hangs on to for supplements and things like that, the fact that the mechanic is there, the framework is there to do that, I think is pretty exciting.
Scott, I think it's really interesting that you bring up the topic of heritage and lineage and how Cobalt Press caught a little bit of criticism for the term race in the announcement they made a week or two ago. I think it highlights a strength and weakness simultaneously of Black Flag and its development. I think there is, in its best form, going to be a really strong blending of old school and new school design philosophy, because you know, the people who are working on this are the folks at Cobalt Press. We've got people like Wolfgang Bauer, who, you know, was the editor of Dragon magazine in the second edition era. I mean, the word tiefling is his creation. Like, that talks to Wolfgang's particular pedigree here. And also Celeste Konowich is doing lead development on this game as well. And Celeste she's fantastic. And she's a person who kind of got her start around the time I was getting my start. You know, she's got a great pedigree as well, but it goes back to like third edition, and that's where she cut her teeth learning how D&D works. And so I like to imagine that in its most idealized form, those two philosophies of game design will come together into a beautiful Reese's peanut butter cup of game design goodness. But I'm sure that as it develops, and like any RPG, apparently all of its growing pains will be public now, ever since 5e decided to do it in 2014. All of its growing pains will be public to us. We will see where that melding becomes tension and friction and how it gets resolved. And I like the potential that this has. And I think it will be cool to see us, while we see this, go like, oh, I don't like that. And then get to see it ironed out in the next playtest packet.
Yeah, I'll be curious to see how they expand on this, because there were a few things, you know, they're looking for feedback. And one thing I was a little bit surprised by with the heritage lineage system, while we're sort of discussing that, is how still pretty tied together those two things seem. in the same way that like your race and sub-race were in kind of base 5e. I had anticipated that those two things would be entirely divorced from one another and that you would be able to basically choose a lineage to be able to inform, you know, certain abilities that a dwarf may have. And then your heritage kind of informs the other abilities that you have as part of your upbringing. The fact that they're still tied together, I think, is not disappointing, but just a little bit.
Well, they are and they aren't, though, because they are what you're thinking of. They can be mixed and matched freely.
Oh, can, okay.
But the presentation might make you think otherwise, right, because there are two suggested heritages that are placed next to each one, and that's where their full description is, right? It's not just like bullet point for a human, the suggested heritages are bup, and then there's a big list of them later. That's something that, you know, the format informs game design, right? this is where we get to nerd out about how graphic design informs the way people learn how to play a game.
Yeah,
it just happened.
It also informs how skimming a document an hour and a half before you be on a podcast. Because what I was going to ask, but thank you for correcting me.
What's the percentage of people who do a deep read of an RPG manual like that? I would posit that most people read an RPG book the way you did. They kind of went through it quick, and then if they need to pull out anything in particular, they'll go directly to it and, you know, kind of tunnel vision on it.
Yeah, sure.
I think you've just playtested the average user experience.
I mean, for me, there is some advantage to this presentation as well, though, because especially that mythical market of people who've never played an RPG before, and you want your game to be the first game they come into. When those people come in, they have the same archetypes from fantasy that everybody else is familiar with. So they may come in and they're looking, oh, a dwarf. I can make him a forge dwarf, or I can make him a stone dwarf, right? This is really cool, right? This fits into my expectations. This makes it very easy for me to build my first character. But having the rules set down, having it, you know, clear and black and white in that section, that you're not limited to that, then lets players take it to the next level when they're ready to. I think the alternative of having like a section on lineage and then a section on heritages, you get into a situation much like some people were worried about with the one D&D background presentation, which is just like, there's six pages of backgrounds here for me to leaf through. That may be too much if I'm sitting down for my first game and I want to build a character in about 15, 20 minutes.
Yeah. Right? Okay. That's a fair point. Yeah. This is a little bit meat and potatoes, but I think like quite granular, but I think it'll matter to a lot of DMs and players, and it jumped out at me. Point buy system. You can start with an ability score of 18. That seems pretty high for a first or even third level character to be able to reach. How are we feeling?
I think it's interesting that they say right at the beginning, if you want to play a typical 5e character alongside a black flag character, give the 5e character a feat at first level just to be on the safe side.
Yeah,
I think that kind of speaks to what you're noticing here.
Yeah, it does. It does actually say right in the preamble, player characters created using the, and this is their in brackets, the core fantasy system. I guess.
Sure. Yeah.
Meaning they're haven't thought about a final name yet. Are slightly more powerful than characters created using 5th edition. You know, they're putting that right up front, and it's interesting. It's definitely good for people who want to try to mix and match the two systems. But it does kind of raise the question, and this is going to become really interesting as we see more 5th edition based games come out over the next little while. Sean is nodding sagely, of what kind of power creep we're going to see just at the very baseline. Not in terms of like, you know, if you want, like your most powerful characters might be more powerful than the most powerful 5e characters, but just characters right across the whole band of levels. Right, are going to be just slightly tougher, slightly stronger, slightly more mechanically robust. And to see if we get into I can't imagine that we're going to get into like a 5e compatible arms race with different games, you know, so Cubicle 7 looks at what Cobalt Press is doing with Black Flag and says, oh, we can do better than that. So they push the envelope a little bit more.
And I just see Nigel Tufnell from Spinal Tap going, my characters go to 11. Well, why don't you just make 10 a little more powerful? But mine goes to 11.
It's 11.
And then what does 1D&D do?
Yeah.
in response to everyone else's games having a little bit more power level. Did they take it up a notch? So part of me wishes I wasn't embedded in the industry, and just to step back business wise and do a case study on what's about to unfold over these next 2 years, because it's going to be so interesting in terms of marketing, in terms of game design, in terms of, you know, who are you going to go after? Who is your focus group? Who is your core audience going to be? It's totally fascinating. And, unfortunately, I have to be in the middle of it too.
Poor Sean.
Poor Sean. Yeah.
The thing that interests me about this particularly, though, and talking about power creep is, you know, and again, I've just skimmed this, so there may be other answers to this because I feel like my questions are being answered, which is great, honestly. But the way that ability scores are being improved, that being the power creep, for me, once characters get past like 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th level, they've got a proficiency bonus of like +4. They might have other abilities that it gets to a point where it's like, well, if the monster has an AC that's less than 15, what are you even really rolling the dice for? You have such a small chance of missing this attack. It feels like you're really just rolling the dice for show. And as that gets brought down, through the different levels, that problem becomes a problem earlier and earlier. What I would like to see in power creep is like first level characters with more health or more diverse abilities, so that as an early level game, the dungeon master can throw more interesting monsters at the players. Playing at lower levels 5e, the thing that I always found was like, I really want to use this monster, but it's just going to destroy the party because they don't have enough health. They don't have enough abilities to be able to deal with this thing. They don't have a spell which they might get a level or two later. But once they get to that level, the monster's only got an AC of 12, so it's just going to get destroyed. It's like the balance is so hard there.
This is something that's risen to the forefront of my mind a number of times throughout the years, and it's just happened again as I've played Bloodborne to completion for the first time, which, if you have never heard of Dark Souls before, is a game where you go up against horrifying monsters and you get your ass handed to you repeatedly. Put the mature rating. Repeatedly, and you fight against these monsters over and over and over again, dying over and over again until finally you figure out what it's like to beat them. And I always think about how D&D has no room for a playstyle like that because death is it. You know, maybe you can get resurrected if your friends manage to hightail it out of there or prevail in the end. But it's very hard to stage a successful retreat in 5e. Generally speaking, once you're committed, you're committed. And if you are playing first level, there's often no margin for error for putting your toe in the water. You'd better be ready to fight, or you had been, or, you know, you planned this encounter as a long range skirmish anyway. So I don't think D&D will ever really solve the problem of, I want to try this encounter over and over and over again until I figure it out. That's just a completely incompatible playstyle. But I do like the idea of you being able to learn a bit more and then judge if an encounter is, you know, beyond your abilities and get the heck out of there.
Yeah.
There's two things that jumped out at me, if you don't mind me talking
more. Please.
One, I noticed that they use the 5e title font all over this PDF. I think that's very funny. no value judgment there. They just use that, whatever it is, the one on the book covers, the one that Trader Joe's also uses on their like chicken strips. Also, there's no feats. There's things called talents, but there's no feats. And in fact, they split up the talents into magic talents, martial talents, and technical talents. That looks pretty cool. A lot of these look kind of like feats that are in the player's handbook already. Elemental Savant is a lot like whatever the elemental feat in the player's handbook is. But I don't know. I'm interested to see how these talents develop, because their new sort of stylistic breakdown, the fact that they've renamed it, suggests to me that, unlike many of the things in here, which they decided to keep right along the 5e line, the word feat, and even one example feat, is in the SRD, if I'm remembering correctly. They could have used feat, but they didn't. And that suggests to me that they've got something else in mind. Maybe something that looks a little bit like Aurora's granular character creation. Maybe there will be a lot of feats. Maybe the feats will help you be incredibly customizable with your character. I don't know. This is a pretty slim packet yet. These are early days.
Yeah.
I'm excited to see what they become.
One thing that really jumped out at me, just even beyond the content of the package, which I thought was pretty cool for the most part, is just the idea that this is a game that Cobalt Press is presenting to us, right? Mm. You know, the fact that it hews as closely to 5e as it does creates a impression that, like, I can easily imagine 2 years ago or even a year ago, something like this with these ideas, the ideas that are at the heart of what Cobalt Press is doing here, might have been a supplement as opposed to a completely different system. This might have been Cobalt Press's answer to Tasha's Cauldron of Everything, right? Hey, we're going to do some, you know, talents. We're going to split up races into heritage and ancestry, right? And the fact that they've chosen to do that in a different way is really fascinating to me. A lot of it may have had something to do with what's happened in the OGL, but certainly they didn't put an entire game together, you know, over a period of a month and a half. Right, I think they've talked about having been working on this for quite a while. So these ideas clearly have been percolating for some time, and it's really, really interesting to me to see that we seem to have entered a very different design space in the aftermath of what happened with the OGL, where people, even people who are back on side, was saying, you know, I may not trust Wizards of the Coast completely, but I understand that they understand what they did wrong, and that going forward, you know, they will do things differently. People are still in a position of saying, you know, it might be nice for us just to do something, just push a little bit further past the stuff that we've been doing the last few years, right? And to see what we can do in this completely unmapped space for the most part, right? I think Level Up 5e is probably the first, if I'm not mistaken, the first kind of 5e compatible game that took the 5e core and then built on it to do something slightly different. Mm. There's going to be so many of these games coming out the next little while. It's going to be really fascinating to see what people do and to see how much compatibility. It's going to be interesting to see where they maintain compatibility and where they view parts of the game as being, this is the thing that we really want to do something new and exciting with.
I'm really interested in seeing this from an inside the industry perspective as well, too, because a lot of designers I've spoken to are starting to feel 5e fatigue, and the sort of emotional fallout of the OGL has only exacerbated that.
Sure.
So with that in mind, I actually am surprised that this first Black Flag packet hews so closely to 5e, because I feel like the knee-jerk reaction for a lot of designers out there right now is, give me something else! For God's sake, give me something else! I'm tired of this system. And it makes me feel that, actually, these people really like 5e. If even after 10 years of 5e, they want to stick with this core, they must really believe in it. And not only that, they must believe in their own power for it, too.
I mean, go ahead, Sean.
What's going to be interesting for me is, here's an opportunity for companies that choose to do so to go off and fix the problems that 5e had. And that's where my focus is going to be. Yes, all of this is interesting and intricate, and you can do different things with it, but it does hew very close to 5e. Let's see how they fix the problem of high-level play.
Sure.
Let's see how we all fix the problems of the math at higher levels and monsters at higher levels. That's where things are going to get really interesting as we do try to fix the gameplay problems that 5e has shown in the, you know, 10 years that it's been out.
Yeah, for sure. Just quickly from the chat, generalities, for 5e fatigue. I like that. That was very funny. I mean, I think its popularity is probably among designers, its popularity among companies is because every kind of company who's made their bones over the last, you know, 7 years, Ghostfire Gaming among them, has done so on 5e, kind of is aware, and this includes Wizards, I think, as well, looking at what 6th edition is shaping up as, that this is a popular system, that this is attracting people into the hobby, that this is kind of, whether it's a great creative outlet for designers anymore, it's still the system that has made the hobby as popular as it is and as financially successful as it is, not just for Wizards, but also for the third parties. And so it's kind of like, yeah, of course, like we want to keep that golden goose alive, because it seems like that's what the audience are clamoring for and discovering and rediscovering again.
InfoBro makes a great point in chat. Fix the underpowered marshals and win my love and devotion. We didn't even talk about the martial maneuver system that we're having in Valakan
there
clans.
There is so much in Valakan clans. There is so much in there.
Some companies are already working on these problems, InfoBro. We've got you covered.
There's a new martial maneuver using subclass for all 12 the PHB core classes in Raider's Guide to Valaka, and they all slap.
They do. They're they're incredible. Yes. I will reveal more perhaps on the stream. Taos just had a quick question in chat, and I'm not entirely sure what they mean by this. Is Black Flag a heartbreaker?
The fantasy heartbreaker. I say no more.
Yeah, it depends on what you call, it depends on your definition of heartbreaker. And there are going to be a lot of them coming out, and some people's hearts will be broken. Some people will absolutely love whatever game they latch onto. And we're going to see, the market will bear out what wins and what loses in the long run.
Many a time has an outside company tried to do D&D, but it's better this time. And they, or in a non-gaming example, you know, write Lord of the Rings, but it's the new fantasy hotness, except this time it's the year 2020 and I'm publishing it. These fantasy heartbreakers always strive for enormous success to be the new epic for a new generation. And, you know, 999 times out of 1,000, they flop.
The WoW killer.
The WoW killer.
The yes. Halo killer.
Gotcha. The Halo killer, yeah. I think Kobold Press has a really good system on their hands. I mean, they're starting from 5e. It's hard to... It's hard to not be off to a good start when you're working on that sort of chassis.
As mentioned, Valakan Clans, the Kickstarter, that's what we were talking about, is going live on Wednesday, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Pacific. It'll be 7 a.m. And then we're doing a stream, which is starting at 6 p.m. Pacific. 6 p.m. Eastern. Eastern succeeded my role against the time zones this time. And it'll be 3 p.m. Pacific. If you want to catch the Lorecast, if you've missed previous episodes, if you're new this week, you can find us on Ghostfire Podcasts, which is the YouTube channel. Head over there, subscribe, like, do all the things. It really helps get the podcast out to more listeners. We had a bit of a boost in listenership over the last few episodes. So if you are new as of the last few episodes, welcome. We're very glad you're here. And thank you for joining the conversation. Thank you for the Twitch chat for jumping in this week and conversing with us. We will be back next week, I've been Ben Byrne here with Sean Merwin, James Hake, Scott Fitzgerald Gray, and we will be back for another episode next week. Yeah.